It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Now, there are recently enacted two military provisions, and these are important. And one, which is called exigency leave, is for people who are basically about to be deployed or whatever, and it's leave time. You can go to the Department of Labor website and print down all the grounds, but there are, I think, 12 categories of situations which exigency leave could be done. Let's say your husband or your spouse is leaving for military service deployment, and you just need to get forms filled out with the banks and all, and changing accounts, and just doing logistical things. It has nothing to do with medical. It is logistical time to help accommodate a person about to be deployed or in active duty.
Employment law attorney Phyllis Katz gives us a comprehensive look at the Family and Medical Leave Act and the new military leave entitlements added to the act in 2009. And during this week's question and answer session, we discuss what to do when your landlord illegally locks you out or threatens to do so. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 133, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. In a report released earlier this month, John O'Brien, a Massachusetts Register of Deeds, discovered that 75% of the mortgage assignments in the Essex County Registry are invalid. The audit looked at 565 assignments issued to and from J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, Wells Fargo Bank, and Bank of America during 2010, and found only 16% of assignments were valid, 9% were questionable, and 75% were invalid. Of the invalid assignments, 27% were fraudulent, 35% were robo-signed, and 10% violated the Massachusetts mortgage fraud statute. There also were 683 missing assignments, representing about $180,000 in lost recording fees locally and about $400 million statewide. The report comes in the midst of settlement talks with banks by the 50 state attorneys general into foreclosure practices. According to O'Brien, this type of criminal fraud is rampant across the nation and leads him to question why anyone would consider settling with the banks until we know the full amount of damage they have caused to homeowners' chain of title and the amount of money they have bilked the taxpayers for their failure to pay recording fees. The full report is available at www.homepreservationnetwork.com. In other news, proposals to slash funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, would be devastating to the more than 700,000 people in Virginia who depend on what were formerly known as food stamps to help feed their families, according to a petition drive involving nearly 70 organizations across the state. Religious, mental health, senior, and children's organizations in Virginia are among those which have signed the petition. The U.S. House has voted to cut SNAP's funding by about 20% and change the program to a block grant structure. Block grants come with preset funding limits, says Ellen Vollinger, legal director for the Food Research and Action Center, and are not as flexible to respond to needs during rough economic times and natural disasters, something she says the program does very well in its current form. The SNAP program is the nation's first defense against hunger and very important to about 44 million people across the country. Nearly 80% of Virginia's SNAP recipients are households with children, and the rest are mostly seniors and people with disabilities. More information is available at www.frac.org. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Malpass v. Morgan. In 1969, the City of Portsmouth Circuit Court held that William Malpass withheld his consent to adoption of his child by the stepfather, Edgar Morgan, contrary to the best interests of the child, and entered an order allowing the adoption. It was uncontested that both homes furnished a proper atmosphere for the child, that the biological father had not done anything to require termination of his parental rights, and that he was exercising regular visitation. But the circuit court held that adoption was in the best interests of the child because the visitation schedule created friction between the biological father and the custodial family. The Supreme Court of Virginia reversed, saying that an adoption without the consent of the biological father required a showing that continuing the relationship between parent and child was detrimental to the child's welfare. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Malpass v. Morgan is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
It's time once again for this week's question and answer session, and we're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Would you tell us your name and where you're from?
My name is Cheryl from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Cheryl. What question do we have this week?
I would like to know if a landlord can lock you out of your apartment and tell you to call back to remove your things or remove the cable box from your apartment.
And was the cable box part of the rental agreement?
Yes, it was.
Okay, Cheryl, the answer to your question is very simple. The answer is absolutely not. No landlord in Virginia is allowed to lock you out of the apartment, to change the locks, to cut off utilities or to remove any essential service, or to evict you by himself or herself through what we call self-help eviction. All landlords are required by law to follow proper legal eviction procedures, and that means giving the tenant a written notice, whether it's a 5-day pay or quit notice if it's non-payment of rent, or a written 30-day notice to vacate in all other cases, waiting out the notice period, then going to the general district court, filing what's called a summons for unlawful detainer, going to court and getting a judgment of possession, then waiting the proper period, which can be 10 days if the tenant shows up in court, and can be no days immediately if the tenant does not show up in court, and then getting the court to issue what's called a writ, W-R-I-T, writ of possession, and then the writ of possession goes to the sheriff. The sheriff then serves or legally delivers the paper on the tenant, then has to wait at least 72 more hours, although usually they wait about 6 or 7 days, and then the sheriff comes back. And the sheriff, and only the sheriff, can legally evict a tenant. Most landlords know all of this. There are, however, unfortunately, some landlords who don't know it and who try to do illegal evictions, whether it's changing the locks or self-help or cutting off utilities. Those things are completely illegal, and tenants who are threatened with those or tenants to whom that actually happens should immediately, right away, get legal help. Now, what I advise people in that situation to do, if they're threatened with something like that, is to keep a copy of their lease or a rent receipt or a notice from the landlord or anything that shows that they are a tenant on their person at all times. And so if the landlord comes by and tries a self-help eviction or a utility cutoff or changing the locks, I advise the tenant, call 911. Tell law enforcement there's an intruder. When law enforcement comes, they'll see it's the landlord. They'll see that it's a landlord-tenant civil matter. At that point, you, the tenant, show the officer your paper, your lease, your rent receipt, whatever, that shows that you are in fact a tenant and not a trespasser or a squatter or something like that. And 9 times out of 10, probably 99 times out of 100, the officer will tell the landlord, this is a civil matter, you can't do what you're doing, you need to take this matter to court. Is this information helpful to you?
Yes, it is.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show. We're here at Sands Anderson, a law firm in downtown Richmond, and we are speaking once again with employment law attorney Phyllis Katz, and today we are going to be talking about the Family and Medical Leave Act, or FEMLA. Welcome back to the show, Phyllis.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Good. Now, will you tell our listeners briefly, what is the Family and Medical Leave Act, or FEMLA, as we'll call it for short?
The Family and Medical Leave Act is a law passed in the early 90s, a federal law, that allows employees of larger employers, because an employer has to have 50 employees or more within a 75-mile radius to even have the act applied to its workplace, to allow employees of such employers up to 12 weeks of leave, job-protected leave, in a 12-month period.
Now, how long does an employee have to have worked for an employer in order to be covered by this act?
The employee has to have worked 12 months, and the 12 months is not consecutive. It could be over a course of time. The law was recently amended to say if there was a break in service of over 7 years, anything behind that break in service is not counted. But generally, you look back at any course of employment with that employer. And as long as it accumulates to 12 months, then you've worked long enough for that employer to be eligible.
And what about part-time employees? Are there a certain number of hours that you need to have worked during those 12 months to be covered by the act?
It covers both part-time and full-time employees. But for both full-time and part-time employees, you've had to work 1,250 hours in the past 12 months. So if you have an employee that had accumulated huge amounts of vacation time, for example, took off for 4 months, and then has some illnesses as well, they may not have worked the 1,250 hours.
Now, assuming that an employee is covered, what are the reasons for taking family and medical leave?
There are several reasons, and medical reasons are a serious health condition of the employee's child, the employee's spouse, or the employee's parent. It is not in-laws, for example. If your in-law, your mother-in-law or father-in-law is ill, you can't take off for that. It has to be a parent. But that term, both parent and child, is fairly expansive. It is somebody who is the biological child. It could be the child that they're caring for in loco parentis, but they need some relationship with it. And likewise, a parent, if you had lived with an aunt for a part of your life and you still have that relationship with that aunt, you could take time off because they were a parent, if you will, under that law.
Now, what do we mean by a serious health condition? I mean, certainly it means more than just a common cold or a case of the flu. What do we mean by a serious health condition?
A serious health condition has two components to it. If it's the serious health condition of the employee, well, a serious health condition, the medical component, is inpatient care, meaning overnight stay in a hospital, a hospice, rehabilitation facility, an overnight stay, and continuing care after that. Or it can mean an incapacity, being unable to work for 3 days, over 3 days, and continuing care. Continuing care means you have to be seen by a doctor at least twice. And the third type of serious health condition are the chronic ones, where you are on a course of treatment because of a condition that maybe sometime in the past you were incapacitated for those 3 days, but currently you may not be, but are still being treated. Common example would be diabetes, where you may not have an absence from work to trigger the leave, but you've had it sometimes in the past and you are under continuing care. There are three other family and medical leave situations, and one is parental care. I call it parental care.
Okay, so what are the other reasons that an employee can ask for FEMLA leave?
Birth of a child. Now, family and medical leave is not there for pregnancy unless the mother, the pregnant mother, has medical conditions and falls under a serious health condition. But you need nothing more than the birth of a child, and either parent of the child can take time off, and you can call this parental care. I like to use it that term, but it's the bonding time. You want time off. And the rules on this for taking it are a little different, because that has to be taken in the first 12 months following the birth, where there is not that kind of requirement in the other areas. Now, there are recently enacted two military provisions, and these are important. And one, which is called exigency leave, is for people who are basically about to be deployed or whatever, and it's leave time. You can go to the Department of Labor website and print down all the grounds, but there are, I think, 12 categories of situations which exigency leave could be done. Let's say your husband or your spouse is leaving for military service deployment, and you just need to get forms filled out with the banks and all, and changing accounts, and just doing logistical things. It has nothing to do with medical. It is logistical time to help accommodate a person about to be deployed or in active duty. The second type of military leave is the care for an injured service member. And again, this has to be an active duty or was on active duty. It can't be someone who's disabled and on disability. And again, here you get up to 24 weeks of leave for the care of an injured service member. So these are new provisions, but they're very important in this day and age when so many people are in the military.
And are there any other reasons for an employee to ask for leave under this act?
With the parental leave, we didn't talk about adoption, foster care placement, and other things such as that, yes.
So let's assume that an employee has one of the reasons for which family and medical leave can be requested. Take us through the process. What is the employee supposed to do initially? What happens after that? What happens after that?
The law says as soon as the leave is foreseeable, and it has 30 days, at least 30 days, unless it arose between the 30 days and the time the leave is done, an emergency thing that has come up, you're supposed to ask your employer for the leave. And you could be disqualified if you do not do it in a timely way. So you want to make sure that as soon as you know the leave. There's also rules on intermittent leave. And unless there's a medical reason, intermittent leave needs to be arranged with the employer. And the regulations make it clear that doctor's appointments that can be made after work hours are supposed to be made after work hours. So the logistics. So my advice to employees is, as soon as you know the need is necessary or may be necessary, make your request. Then you can get whatever documentation to support it that the employer may require, and there's less confusion. But the law says as soon as it's foreseeable, but no less than 30 days. The other thing that is required is to follow employers' policies. This has recently been added. So you can be completely disqualified. You can have your serious health condition. You can have the birth of the child. But if you're not requesting the leave, as your employer's policies state, In other words, call in advance, get permission of your supervisor, and other things. You can disqualify yourself from entitlement.
And how is the employee supposed to know what the employer's policies are? In other words, is the burden on the employee to ask what the policies are, or is the burden on the employer to provide information as to what those policies are once the employer has received the request?
Well, if an employer is going to argue that their own policies, we would hope that he had given them to, or he or she had given them to the employee to know. It's going to be hard for an employer to argue that there were policies when no one saw them. But sometimes a policy can be articulated by a supervisor. So the first time you make a request and they say, no, you should have done it earlier. This is what is required. We need 2 days' notice. Then that policy has been communicated to that employee, and we could argue that.
And does the law require that the request be in writing, or can it be oral?
The law does not require a written request. Again, it's important to establish that the request had been made, to have it in writing. But the law has been modified so that there are now a series of forms. And the first thing, as soon as a supervisor knows leave is requested, and it may be for the military purposes that we discussed, or it may be for the serious health condition reasons, or for the birth of a child, the employer has 5 days to get an eligibility notice. And what that eligibility notice says to the employee is that you've worked the 12 months, you have 1,250 hours, and you'll qualify, and this is what it'll qualify for, and there's a checklist, a serious health condition of employee, a family member, care of child, whatever it may be.
And finally, what happens at the end of the 12-week period? How is that process supposed to work when the employee is to come back? And what happens if the employee simply can't come back at the end of the 12 weeks?
The employee has job-protected status, meaning that job or a similar job with similar benefits and responsibilities is waiting for him at the end of the 12 weeks. If the employee can't come back, there's no guarantee that the job will remain, and the employee might be fired. Now, there are obligations on an employer when you're dealing with not the military leave, not the parental leave, because those are just births and events that have occurred, but with the serious health condition of an employee, that there may be some accommodations under other laws, such as the Americans with Disabilities Act.
And would the employer essentially be put on notice because of the FEMLA leave that they need to look at the question of reasonable accommodations?
A tickler, I would say, because we can't presume that someone is disabled. That would be violating the Americans with Disabilities Act if we presume a person who's on family and medical leave for a serious health condition is disabled. And that's sort of a trick. But once the employee says, I am unable because of a physical or mental impairment to return to work at the end of my 12 weeks, that's enough, if you will, communication to the employer to say, well, we have an accommodation request and we have a physical and mental impairment, and maybe we need to find out more about this impairment, which the Family and Medical Leave Act doesn't require much medical information as to impairment, if you will, inability to do life functions. It's different test, but it's certainly enough notice for an employer to make a further inquiry. Tell us more, and let's see about discussing what can be done in the workplace.
Thank you very much. We have been speaking with Phyllis Katz. She is an employment law attorney at the downtown Richmond law firm of Sands Anderson. Thank you very much for being on the show.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 20, which deals with domestic relations. Under Code of Virginia 20-122, whoever prints, publishes, distributes, or circulates, or causes to be printed, published, distributed, or circulated any circular, pamphlet, card, handbill, advertisement, printed paper, book, newspaper, or notice of any kind offering to procure or aid in procuring any divorce, either in the Commonwealth of Virginia or elsewhere, shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor, and on conviction fined not less than $190, nor more than $300, except that this statute does not apply to attorneys. However, with the coming of the internet, this statute probably has been violated 18 million times, which is the number of hits on a Google search for the phrase Virginia divorce. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. The show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The Americans with Disabilities Act revolutionized employment law for people with disabilities. Join us next week when Stephen Traubert, staff attorney at the Virginia Office for Protection and Advocacy, describes the laws that protect people with disabilities against discrimination in employment in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on February 10, 2010. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. Oh.